This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This summer, I took time out to walk the river trail, to grow some of my own food, get the firewood in, to love life and the earth. I should be happy, but instead, I'm angry. This great life is becoming the facade which hides much greater evil. More than ever, we are being played. Whether it's Vladimir Putin scheming to replace democracy with right-leaning autocrats around the world, or the Koch brothers spending millions to feed our doubts about climate change, it's all heading in the same ugly direction. Yes, I've been entertained by the greatest geopolitical drama of this century. I checked the Twitter feeds of Claude Taylor at True Facts Stated and Louise Mensch to get the inside track on the Trump investigations. But all that is just a shadow of the goblin that is rearranging the atmosphere, the poles, the oceans, and the landscape. The demon is us. Just consider the hoped-for recovery from Hurricane Harvey. Just now, Canada has an extra 400,000 barrels a day of heavy oil from the tar sands with no place to go. Pre-Harvey, it was processed in the refineries in Texas. Nobody else can do it, so the price of Canadian crude drops along with the Canadian dollar. We're told up to 500,000 cars and trucks were rendered useless by the hurricane floods. It took a lot of carbon to make all that steel and plastic. Just when the car industry was heading into another cycling slump, we'll get an additional burst of warming carbon just to replace the Harvey-damaged vehicles. With what we know now, we shouldn't be making another single internal combustion engine. Let's spend more billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, on concrete and heavy equipment to replace the roads and freeways for those carbon burners. Let's spend another $500 billion on more building materials and shipping to replace all those homes. Of course, since we believe in freedom no matter what, people will put those roads and homes right back in the flood zones. That's partly because officially climate change does not exist. It cannot even be named in some departments in the new federal administration or in Texas. Planning to avoid the next disaster is prohibited by law. That's how deadly crazy things have become. Maybe because I work on the fringes of the media, I'm maddest at the media. We have some good work on the Russia investigation from a few big newspapers and a couple of cable news outlets. But even they fall into stories about puppy dogs, shallow coverage of big storms with lots and lots of flag waving. It's one big propaganda machine. Take this coverage by the American cable channel MSNBC. Finally, after a million hours of climate silence on the other networks, they stumble on a correspondent who wants to stand in the middle of a Texas flood and tell us how it is. Let's listen in.
Joining us live on the ground in Beaumont, the first camera to get there is my old friend Shihab Ratansi, Al Jazeera English reporter. His hotel is surrounded by water. He cannot get out of it, but he's got a shot. Shihab, what's the situation as you've seen it?
We're surrounded, as you said, as so many people are in Beaumont. We can take a look. I mean, we're at an island of calm, an oasis of dryness relative. But already this water is beginning to come up over here. This is I-10 behind us. Sections of this are now closed. Down there is Louisiana. That's the road we took to get here. The whole section moving to Louisiana is now shut, we understand. It's interesting listening to the mayor, though, just then, because we were listening to the mayor as well last night. If you were a resident in Beaumont last night and you are watching local television, you would have been reassured by what the mayor said, by what the weather forecaster said. This wasn't going to be as bad as this. I remember the mayor talking about all the investment they've done in drainage for roads and things like that. It's pretty clear something has gone wrong here with the forecasting and with the preparation. Clearly, the roads are now waterlogged. We understand 500 roads just in the southeast region are flooded. Actually, let me put this in difficult context. I know you were talking to someone in Port Arthur a moment ago. We're in what's called the Golden Triangle in the south. Now, you know, it's interesting. The reason why it's called the Golden Triangle is because this is the first place in the United States where they discovered large quantities of oil in 1901.
Right.
And that led to the Texas oil boom and the huge amounts of money come pouring into this region. It's pretty clear, though, that despite that, money has not been flowing into this region for the infrastructure, for the climate change effects that we knew were inevitable because of the oil and gas industry's activities on this coastline. even as those oil and gas industries were covering up what they knew about climate change in the 70s. I have to go on about this. Ali, you're an Al Jazeera guy. We get to the point on Al Jazeera.
Yep.
So that is very striking for us here. So much money has been made on this region,
and it hasn't gone into the infrastructure
to deal with the climate change that was inevitable
industry. Hold that thought for 1 second, because on the screen we've got a live helicopter rescue. I believe I'm going to ask my control room. This is in Beaumont. Miguel Almaguer, I believe, is on that helicopter. They have lowered the basket to get somebody from the water. This is a Navy helicopter.
That's right. Just as the Al Jazeera reporter winds up to explain how Texans have been fleeced and left in danger by the oil industry, the camera gets whisked away to watch another helicopter rescue of some human. It's like calling squirrel to a dog. They can't resist. So after the unsuspecting gentleman is hauled up into the helicopter and into our living room screens, our MSNBC host manages to get back to his man on the ground. That reporter begins to wind up again about climate, big oil. Well, oh my gosh, they lose the connection, and they move on to another meaningless, surreal TV opportunity. Even the most left-leaning network just can't handle the truth. Sad. I'll be right back with Zoe Carpenter from The Nation.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Remember Hurricane Katrina revealed shocking poverty in New Orleans and ongoing pollution from petrochemical plants? Add millions more people and the world's largest chemical corridor, and you've got Houston, Port Arthur, and all that after Hurricane Harvey. But as Wen Stevenson wrote in The Nation magazine on August 29th, Houston's human catastrophe started long before the storm. While the mainstream media grandstands with weather porn and pictures of dogs being rescued, let's go to Zoe Carpenter, associate editor for The Nation magazine. Zoe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
It took a couple of days before we saw even brief photos of flooded refineries on ABC or Fox News, but the reporter never explains what that really means. What is the real story lurking there?
Well, the real story is that although this natural disaster was beyond anything that we've experienced before on the Gulf Coast in recent history, there were lots of warnings and lots of things that could have been done to at least prepare better, especially when it comes to the chemical facilities, when it comes to the development in the area. And I think the overarching story is that as we look ahead, these kinds of extreme weather events are going to challenge many more of our cities. And if we don't actually start looking forward instead of just rebuilding and assuming things are going to be the way that they were in the 1970s in terms of flooding and things like that, this is just going to keep happening.
Why does Wen Stevenson say the catastrophe in Houston started long before Harvey arrived?
Well, part of it is, you have lots of factors here. So the catastrophe partly is related to development. There's been unchecked and relatively loosely regulated development in Houston into floodplains, which covers up prairie that used to absorb some of excessive rainfall. Of course, it wouldn't have absorbed all of 50 inches, but it would have absorbed some of that flooding. That prairie has now been covered up by concrete. You have building into low-lying areas that regularly flood. And then you have this pre-existing disaster of especially poor communities of color living near petrochemical plants, living in areas that are dangerous. And so that disaster has been around for decades.
And an estimated 80% of Houston residents don't have flood insurance. According to a new Harris poll, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck if they have a job. What does the devastation of Hurricane Harvey mean for them?
Well, for them, it means a very uncertain future. I think we're still in the stage where people are just starting to return to check out the damage of their homes in some cases. I think most of this week we've been focused on the immediate safety concerns. But for the people that don't have flood insurance, many of them may be unable to rebuild their homes, or if they're renters, imagine if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're renting an apartment and suddenly all of your furniture is ruined, the car that you depend on to get to work is no longer functional, These could be serious life-changing circumstances for people with no clear way for how to get out of them.
You know, when I heard that dozens of doctors volunteered to attend the Houston Convention Center to help evacuees, I thought, this may be the first time some of those people have seen a doctor in years. They can't afford medical care. Talk to us about the health impacts of living in America's oil refinery.
Well, there are many, and they compound upon themselves. So there is evidence that rates of certain cancers are higher in communities near the petrochemical facilities. And again, those are largely communities that are lower income and of color. So there are serious environmental justice concerns. Now with the hurricane and the flooding, we have other more acute health issues related to infections from the water. There are many communities that don't have access to potable water right now. And then, of course, you have the larger problem of health insurance and lack of access to care more generally. So the Houston population, about a fifth of it is below the poverty line. Texas is very strict in terms of its requirements for eligibility for Medicaid. So you have these sort of chronic health issues that may have been exacerbated by the flooding. People who need access to dialysis need access to medicines, who need to see a doctor, who, you know, may be pregnant and need to see their prenatal physician, now suddenly will face more barriers just to accessing basic care.
And when those refineries shut down, including America's largest, they don't just turn off a tap or turn out the lights. The Houston Chronicle was reporting that, quote, 2 million pounds of dangerous chemicals were released in Houston when they shut down between Monday and Wednesday. More has been released since then, and millions more will be released when the plants restart. Zoe, have you heard more about that?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that these refineries really aren't meant to be shut down and restarted the way that they were forced to. And so what happens is when you shut them down and restart them is you do have these excess emissions. And the companies file these reports, but they don't get sanctioned for these emergency emissions because it's an emergency situation. And so the impacts of that obviously fall upon the communities that live most closely to those refineries. And many did report unbearable chemical smells in the air, and many of them weren't able to evacuate. So not only have they been living near these petrochemical plants full-time and experiencing sort of the daily cumulative effects of those chemicals, but now they're trapped near this sort of acute, drastic emissions because of the storm. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that this isn't just accidental. The Texas politicians and the companies themselves have worked for many years to weaken or prevent regulation from these companies. So Arkema, which is a chemical plant, where there have been a couple of explosions this week, they refused to release their chemical inventory so that we know exactly what chemicals might be being emitted from that plant. And they've also lobbied against a recent rule that was released under the Obama administration called the Chemical Disaster Rule, which would have put in place some more emergency measures, some better audits, and things of that nature. And recently, Scott Pruitt, the new EPA administrator, actually put a hold on that rule. So, like I said, this isn't just an accident.
And with up to 100,000 homes destroyed or just damaged in Houston, there have to be hundreds of thousands of people, I guess, displaced people. Do you think the government of Texas or the federal government will get them the support they need in time and continuing as they need it?
It's hard to imagine that every single person who has been displaced can be compensated properly for what they've lost. I think that's an unrealistic expectation. I think certainly there will be an effort to get emergency money to people and to have temporary housing. But I think the lessons from past disasters, even on a much smaller scale, such as the flooding in Baton Rouge last year, is that certain communities don't get all the help they need to fully recover. That means people living for years with tarps where their roofs used to be because they aren't able to rebuild their roofs. People living in FEMA trailers, and those are supposed to be temporary measures. But we see what's referred to as a new normal settle in, where measures that were supposed to be temporary become permanent as people don't have the support to fully regain what they lost.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Zoe Carpenter of The Nation magazine about some of the underreported news from Hurricane Harvey. Zoe, after watching tons of coverage, hardly anything on climate change is mentioned, much less the role of oil and petrochemical companies in helping cause climate disruption, denying global warming is happening, and making sure there's no regulations to plan for it. Your comments?
I think the conversation, when it does come up, is often framed in a really twisted manner, and people want to know whether we can say with certainty that this hurricane is due to climate change. But that's not really how climate change works. Climate change, it's not like it's some minion that's going to pull a string and a weather disaster is going to occur. Basically, climate change means that the climatic conditions are changing in ways that lead to weather events being more extreme, for example. And so one of the ways in which climate change is very clearly linked to Hurricane Harvey is that as the temperature of the world increases, even just a bit, you have more moisture in the atmosphere, and that's just because of basic laws of physics. And then you also have more movement of that moisture. And so in the case of Houston, we saw that the Gulf of Mexico was much warmer than average temperatures. It was about 1 degree to 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than historically average temperatures. And that meant that there was more moisture in the atmosphere, which led to so much rain being dumped. And another link is because of the way wind patterns and the way that the Gulf Stream has changed in relationship to climate change, the shifting wind patterns led or may have contributed to the hurricane sitting over the Houston area for so many hours and, you know, for days, in fact. And so that's the way, those are some of the ways in which climate change is linked to Harvey. And it doesn't really matter whether we can say that climate change, quote unquote, caused this hurricane. What matters is that we know to expect more of these extreme weather events, and that it's really negligent, to say the least, not to prepare for that coming reality.
I feel like there are 1,000 stories in Hurricane Harvey. We'll be working on this for some time to come. Is it going to change the course of life and history in America, or is it just another blip along the road to a broken climate in a broken system? What do you think?
Well, it certainly will change the course of history for individual people and for individual families whose lives will take a dramatically different course because of this. Whether that gets written in the history books or not, you know, I can't say. I think that, unfortunately, the response from the right politically to this has been consistent with the past, that they're not willing yet to entertain a conversation about climate change. It may change the minds on the individual level, which I think is important. But, you know, part of the problem here is that even if people become more interested in preparing for extreme weather events, it's really hard to prepare for 50 inches of rain in a several-day period. There's only so much we can do. So, yes, we should prepare, but the bottom line is we actually have to do something to mitigate climate change, to stop it from proceeding along its current course, not just adapt to it.
Well, and I think, you know, Texas has its fair share of preppers, and I like to be prepared myself. And certainly if you have some water at home, that helps you when the water supply stops. But if you have to get out of your home, that doesn't help you so much. And I think The Nation ran another article talking about how everybody's an individualist and a libertarian until a catastrophe strikes, and then we're all supposed to be more socialist.
Of course, there's this sort of petty hypocrisy that you can see from some members of Congress who objected to using federal funding for Hurricane Sandy relief, and now they want federal funding for Houston. You know, that's obviously silly, but I don't know that it's worth spending too much time making fun of those people. I don't know how productive that is, but, you know, I think the larger point is that we celebrate the sort of local acts of communalism. So the Cajun Navy coming to help out people in Houston, and that's great. But we shouldn't have to rely on individual acts of heroism to respond to a disaster. This is what government is for preparing for and responding to wide-scale communal disasters. This is a community event that deserves a community response. And by community, I mean not only the individuals that make up a community, but their representatives and their government.
And also lost in the massive coverage by American and international networks is another series of floods in India, Pakistan, and East Asia. Over 1,200 people have died there. You know, why don't we hear in depth with 24-hour coverage about the floods that happen on another part of the world as opposed to what happens in America all the time?
It's troubling. I don't know exactly why. I mean, I think that's part of our inward-looking media culture, and certainly the disaster in India and in Bangladesh, and it's much vaster than the scale of what's happened in Houston, and certainly deserves our attention. And I think that's what we can expect in future years, is that we're going to have these wide-scale disasters that happen in multiple areas of the country, or sorry, multiple areas of the world.
Why is it that The Nation magazine often publishes unpleasant truths when the big news organizations won't?
Well, one reason is perhaps that we're not beholden to our advertisers. You know, we're an independent publication, and, you know, nobody's pulling the strings over there.
Good point. Same here. And as we wrap up, as a journalist, Zoe, what are your impressions of what this record-breaking extreme rainfall event really means as we head into the future?
Well, I think it means that reporters can cover climate in many different ways. And climate change reporting isn't only about extreme weather events, but when we're covering development in a coastal city, does that story include information about sea level rise? When we're talking about immigration and we're talking about all of these other things, how is climate part of the story? And I think that's sort of one of the news lessons to take away from this.
Well, for me, one of the challenges is not to get totally distracted by every disaster, because there's going to be more and more of them, but also to keep my eye on the science and what we really know about our situation and, of course, the solutions. What are we going to do as a society? Are we going to stop driving around in oil-based cars and trucks? What are we going to do? You know, that is a real challenge, not to get focused on the weather porn, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, I do think it's worth, you know, keeping an eye on how individual communities are impacted immediately by the disaster. And I think that we've seen some really amazing local reporting coming out of the Houston Chronicle and other places that is really providing vital resources for the people who are in the area and need information. And that is certainly still a very important and worthwhile function of the news as well.
I agree. I'm still digging. I want to put some links in my show blog at ecoshock.org to some Texas environment groups who've been working on these issues for years, and get them out there for our listeners as well. Zoe Carpenter has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, and other outlets. She regularly writes for The Nation magazine. She's the associate Washington editor there. Follow her on Twitter at Zoe S. Carpenter. And check out thenation.com. Zoe, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And now for a Radio EcoShock roundup of all the news they didn't tell you this summer. As you've heard during the interviews, there were even large floods in eastern Nigeria, Africa, as well as Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. At least 1,200 people died during floods in East Asia during August, and millions are homeless, without any food or hope of government aid. You can Google it, and BBC News in the UK are one of the few English-language networks to cover that. Regular listeners know that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report on extreme weather events, which will increase as the world warms. I've done several programs on extreme rainfall events dating back to 2008. The atmosphere has warmed over 1 degree C, which allows it to hold 7% more water vapor. That means more rainfalls somewhere. It's simple physics. And then there are the fires. I was surrounded by them again this summer. We had more smoke alert days than clear days. It was very hot here, well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees C, day after day. There's been no rain here for almost 2 months. This isn't summer as I ever knew it. In Canada, British Columbia declared its second ever state of emergency as hundreds of forest fires erupted. It's cost about $333 billion to fight them. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated, including from cities. Gigantic valleys burned. The smoke drifted over 1,000 miles to the east. Aboriginal people have been evacuated from northern Manitoba and Saskatchewan provinces as more fires burned there. Crops withered in the key grain-growing parts of southern Saskatchewan. There were major fires in California, Oregon, and Washington as this broadcast goes to air. The West is burning again. That's another predicted outcome of climate change, but even the best scientists did not expect it this early. Let me just skim through some of the headlines that would have been world affairs before these turbulent times. I'll read through them, and you can follow up what interests you through the links posted in my weekly show blog. That appears every Wednesday by 6 p.m. Pacific time at ecoshock.org. In North America, a drought in the Western Plains threatens some of the wheat crop. Sacramento was hit by a record-breaking heat wave. People who attended the Burning Man Festival this year in Nevada suffered through 100-degree Fahrenheit heat, not seen there at this time of year since the 1940s. And they got a massive sandstorm that filled every tent, RV, and nose. It was apocalypse now for those folks at $1,000 a ticket. In July, in nearby Death Valley, California, they set a new global record for the hottest single month ever since official records began in 1911. The East Coast hardly saw a beach day for the month of July. It was strange. New Englanders were on the cool side of the great bending jet stream that's been changed since the Arctic sea ice melted. A heat wave swept over the Arctic in Canada with severe fires in the Northwest Territories. It was the same in Siberia and Russia. Heat, fires, and smoke. We can only imagine the amount of carbon released there, especially when the peat catches fire. And as I've told you, there were fires on Greenland. That's not unheard of, but it's pretty strange to get ones that big. Moving on to Europe. In early August, the Telegraph reported the European heat wave, which killed five, with temperatures soaring above 40 degrees C. In France, wildfires forced mass evacuations in late July, especially along the Mediterranean. As you no doubt heard, there was a sad incident where over 60 members of a Portuguese village were killed trying to flee a fire. The fires in Portugal were declared a public calamity. The great city of Rome faced an unusual water shortage with rationing. Even the Vatican shut off its fountains. Extreme heat decimated crops in Central and Southeast Europe, exposing the riverbeds not seen for centuries in places. Overall in Europe, it was called the Lucifer heat wave, which led to a higher death rate and crop damage. Summer skiing at one Italian glacier was shut down for the first time in 90 years, just another sign of the times. Turkey experienced strange and severe storms. Government workers in Iraq were laid off due to blistering heat. Birds were reported falling dead from the sky when temperatures in Kuwait went over 50 degrees C or 122 degrees Fahrenheit. An eastern province of Nigeria was recently hit by super floods, with countless people losing their homes, cattle, and all their belongings. I've already reported on the super monsoon floods that hit northern and eastern India, leaving hundreds of thousands homeless. In late July, there was another extreme rainfall event and flash flooding in the Kingdom of Bhutan. Torrential rains crippled Karachi, Pakistan on August 31st. The Indian financial capital of Mumbai, formerly Bombay, was shut down by heavy rains and flooding on September 1st. India got 10 times the usual amount of rain within a 10-day time period. Bangladesh was also hit by the super rains. More crisis there. Not much on your television screens. Meanwhile, new science on climate change concludes parts of Southeast Asia will be, quote, unlivable by 2100. Scientists also say living in Pakistan will be difficult by the year 2100 due to long-lasting extreme heat waves. During all this, fossil fuel use is rising, not falling. Yes, greenhouse gas emissions have fallen in America, but the U.S. is still a gigantic source of climate-damaging gases. The rest of the world is trying to catch up and live as the U.S. does, and they're more than filling the American decline. Scientists are reluctantly admitting that the world is almost certain, that's their words, to warm by 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. Believe me, that is a disaster far greater than you or I have ever known. One British investment firm, Schroders, which controls assets worth $542 billion, is far more pessimistic. They think 7 to 8 degrees C of warming is possible. Experts are predicting more humid heat waves, the most dangerous kind for mammals. Another report predicts heat waves up to 55 degrees C or 131 degrees Fahrenheit. That's from the European Joint Commission, and I hope to have the lead author of that report on Radio EcoShock perhaps next week. By the way, did I mention new science shows global ocean circulation is beginning to collapse due to a warming planet? All life depends on that circulation. And last year, 2016, was once again the hottest year ever recorded, according to the State of the Climate in 2016 report. That's led by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, a plus scientist from 60 Nations. 2016, hottest ever once again. And I bet you 2017 sets a new record. Outside my home, it's now too smoky to go outside and breathe. One valley to the west, a new fire erupted last night in the Okanagan near Peachland. In the extreme heat and high winds, it went from 40 hectares to over 1,000 hectares, about 2,500 acres, overnight. In this area, which was already housing evacuees from fires further north, a fresh round of evacuation has already begun. There has been no rain there for a couple of months. The grass, shrubs, and trees are as dry as can be, literally tinder. The sun, shadowed by fire clouds, is blazing red. The hills and the ground are tinted with the colors of sunset at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Something deep inside me, something from our animal roots, something from a million years ago tells me how wrong all this is, how dangerous these times are becoming. There is no end to apocalyptic headlines. While recording this short feature, the largest fire in Los Angeles history popped up. As of September 2nd, the La Tuna Fire grew to over 5,000 acres, according to the L.A. Fire Department. Homes in Burbank and Glendale were evacuated. Los Angeles has fires from time to time. I've lived there, I know. But keep in mind, this is again a record, the largest ever. It was 91 degrees in L.A., but with the humidity, it felt like 104 degrees or 40 degrees C. To the north, San Francisco broke an all-time record high for September 1st. Broke isn't the right word. Jason Salmonow at the Capital Weather Gang says the record was smashed. San Francisco on the sea is known to be cool even in summer. They were not ready for the hottest day ever since records began. It was an astonishing 106 degrees Fahrenheit or 41 degrees C. The previous high was 3 degrees lower than that, and that was in the year 2000. The average high for this time of year in San Francisco, Jason tells us, is around 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 degrees C. So this September 1st was more than 30 degrees above normal. That's got to tell you something. Is all this getting through? We are already in a global climate emergency. That is the real news. Anything else is a distraction. This is the time to fight for our survival and to turn back the tide of extinction. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock as we ride through these turbulent times together.
Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. Thanks.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us.
I've left a small personal story of climate change for the end of this program. It's not a big thrill like the footage from Hurricane Harvey or the fires in France. It's small, but I think there is a point. My family traveled to a nearby mountain lake this summer, as we do every year. We camp out without any electricity except for our small solar panel. One day as we headed out to get more supplies, we saw a massive cloud erupting to the south, tinged with red. We were seeing the start of a forest fire that caused more hundreds to evacuate their homes, this time near Kelowna in British Columbia. As we attempted to get back to the lake, a big windstorm blew through, taking down power lines along the road. And that road was closed by the police for a few hours while the power lines were removed from the pavement. No big problem. We waited and then got back in. At the end of our week in paradise, we drove through another forest road to get home, except there was a fire there. Traffic was only allowed through, 30 cars at a time, escorted by the police. We saw Canadian Army men helping, as firefighters filled big vats of water for the helicopters to pick up. The roadside was black, trees all burned. After a couple of hours, we got through. Getting home, the air was thick with smoke. It was hot and unhealthy to be outside. But we know how to live with that. Our home is very tight, with 2 HEPA air cleaners that can take out the tiny particles before we breathe them in. Unfortunately, I'm going to recommend that for everyone in the West and everyone where a fire can burn. You should have a HEPA air cleaner. It's a special type of air cleaner. I work inside when that happens on the radio program while automated sprinklers keep my garden alive. Everything survives out there. But the tomatoes stop flowering. We will have no fall tomatoes this year. It's a peculiarity that even the professional growers noticed when smoke fills the air. The point is, as climate change gets worse and worse, humans will adapt. And that is the problem. We are so very adaptable. We keep on living the way we do, driving around. I mean, nothing should stop our holidays. We have to get to work. Even as hurricanes flood out homes down the road, or fires burn out neighboring cities, nobody really considers questions like, should we stop driving carbon-based cars? Should we stop buying food or flowers flown in from other countries? Should we really change? I used to think that climate-driven disasters would finally bring the public to their senses. We would take action on a grand scale to save nature and ourselves. But now, looking at my own life, I'm not so sure. Maybe our ability to adapt is what will keep this fossil parade marching right off the cliff. Maybe adapting is the worst policy. I am taking steps to change. A listener and longtime friend just donated an electric bike. I'm so grateful. Now I can go around my village and buy groceries and all that without using fossil fuels. We burn wood in the winter, which saves all kinds of carbon. Trees capture carbon from the atmosphere, so burning it adds nothing. I know we can't all burn wood, especially in cities, or the forests would be doomed. But what I'm talking about is there are options that each of us can take if you look around. My geothermal greenhouse is half built now. The pipes are in the ground. And I finished the concrete block foundation. I hope there is some room to grow food year-round without using fossil fuels. It may even cool the plants during extra hot summers. I'll report more when that is operational. We capture hundreds of gallons of rainwater for the garden from our roof. Use those eavesdrops. We buy used clothing and goods when we can. Don't make new carbon that way. There are a lot of small steps each of us can take. And we not only reduce our carbon footprint, but we lead our neighbors into a more climate-friendly lifestyle as well. Preventing a climate disaster, it's a direction that each of us can take. Please consider what you can do, even in small ways. It could add up, pushing us towards the big change we all need so much. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please try to catch the show, every show, this season.